You're listening to a dayone.fm show.
So I made a landing page, put a proposition out, nothing happened. Promoted it in a few channels, nothing happened. Blah, blah, blah. Like I did that for about a week, nothing happened. And then I try a different channel, maybe tweak the proposition slightly. And I put my personal phone number on there. And I went out to lunch with a friend and the phone rang. And I was like, oh, I'm really sorry. This it must be someone who's seen my thing. And then put to hang up the phone and then my phone rang again. And I was like, oh, that's weird. I answered and said, I'm sorry, I'll call you back in my lunch. And then I went back to my office and the exact combination of like tweaks and channel had just taken off. And I blasted through the target.
Welcome back to Diaspora.nz, where we're on a mission to seek out and profile the hidden gems, the best founders, operators, researchers, and emerging leaders of the great Kiwi expat community. Today, we're chatting with Rachel Carroll, who is a co-founder and CEO at Kora Kids. We had a lot of fun with this episode. We trace Rachel's story from hustling chocolates and homegrown lottery schemes on the streets of Invercargill to strategizing her way into a Rhodes Scholarship that helped her land a place and then finally find her people at the University of Oxford in the UK. And then on to London, where she's been ever since, 22 years and counting, consulting with McKinsey, raising a family and building startups. We explore how, counterintuitively, Rachel feels driven to consistently choose the path of most resistance. She's seeking the right kind of crazy. Shows up in stories from the founding of Kora Kids to the time she had a baby in the middle of her Series A fundraise and was out pitching the next day, to how she thinks about talent development, scaling demand, scaling supply in marketplaces, and much more. We're also joined by a special co-host in today's episode, Phoebe Harrop, a general partner at Blackbird Ventures back in Auckland. We're experimenting with some different show formats over coming weeks, co-hosts, small groups, so stay tuned for that. And if there's one thing you can do to help us out, it'll be send this episode to a friend, to an expat in your family, to a founder or aspiring founder who could benefit from the lessons here. We really appreciate your support. And let's go get stuck in. Welcome back to another episode of Diaspora.nz. Today we're here with Rachel Carroll from Kora Kids and a special co-host, Phoebe Harrop from Blackbird. Guys, welcome. Thank you for coming on.
Hi. Hi.
Hey, Rachel, you've been in the UK probably 20 years at this point from New Zealand. You've notched up a PhD, a half a decade consulting. You worked with the NHS, top IVF clinic. You led a medtech startup to 1 and a bit million customers. You have founded Kora Kids and raised money from some of Europe's best investors in one of the notoriously hardest sectors to build a startup in healthcare and childcare. You've started and raised a family along the way. You're clearly doing life on hard mode, but I'm interested, is there a common thread or a theme or like what has continued to drive you through each of these stages and chapters?
That was quite a nice summary. When you put it like that, sounds like quite a lot. It has been 22 years to make my way through all those things. As of this year, I have spent exactly half my life in New Zealand and half my life in Britain. I'm 44 and I've spent 22 wow. years in each. Feels like a milestone. And that feels real. I feel half British, half Kiwi at this point.
You sound it as well.
Yeah. I think it's just true. I think my culture, the way I relate to people, my accent, I think I literally am half at this point. So I think the common thread, I have always just been drawn by the most interesting thing that is in front of me at the time. So I'm not one of these people who plans their career strategically. I know lots of people like that. I respect it. I think it's cool that they can do it. I never did that. I always just faced the choice that was ahead of me at the time. And when I was evaluating options, I always, pretty much without exception, went, what's going to be the most interesting thing? But I think you kind of said it. I am also actually drawn to hard things. And, you know, there've been quite a number of crossroads in my life where there's been a path that is going to be easier and more comfortable and slightly more boring. And there's been a path which is going to be more interesting, but could be quite brutal. And it's hard to think of a time when I haven't chosen the brutal path. I don't know whether that's me just really prioritizing interest over everything else or also being slightly masochist.
Well, you've given us an episode title already, Choosing the Brutal Path. Take us back to where it came from. So you grew up in the bottom end of the South Island. I've heard that. What's probably not the easiest place to live. Did this feel inevitable that you'd wind up overseas? Or what was the inflection point at which you made the jump?
Definitely didn't feel inevitable. So I grew up in Invercargill. I'm the daughter of two teachers. Invercargill's actually a great place to grow up. Very safe, unbelievably boring. And I think it's really significant that I was born in 1980. I grew up, I was a teenager in the 90s. And the internet came to our high school in 1996 when I was 16. My chemistry teacher had a little room off the side of his classroom where, you know, two people like me and this other girl would kind of go occasionally and like play on the internet. So it's not like it really came, you know. And the reason that's significant is like if I were growing up in Invercargill right now, I think there's a lot of ways that you can escape from Kaggle while physically still being there. You know, you could go on Reddit, you could find your people, you could like, you can lead this really interesting life. At the time when I grew up, you couldn't. Like, there was nothing. And although I had a great group of friends and I'm still in touch with them and I love them very dearly, I was extremely weird. Because there wasn't an internet, there was no way of finding my people in Kaggle. And so I had a couple of experiences where I was very lucky to go to some like international stuff with other weirdo kids. And I became aware that like, although I was weird, I wasn't the only weird one. And so my goal since that moment, since I met them when I was about 16, 17, was to go where the weird kids were. And that definitely wasn't in Kaggle. And then I went to Otago and I met like some, but not quite enough. And so I was always kind of like journey to the center of the earth is what I wanted to go to the center, center, center. And I believed that the center was like a great world university. And so I set myself a really clear goal. First, I tried to do it from high school. I tried really hard. We couldn't afford to pay international fees. My parents were teachers. So I had to win a scholarship. And so I tried really, really hard and I didn't win any. And so I went to Otago and I had a good time, but by then had a new goal, which was like, okay, I'm delayed a few years, but it's okay. I got to win a postgrad scholarship. And so I was very focused on that. And I did end up winning a Rhodes, which took me to Oxford. But I think when I got there, one of the things I noticed was it was quite cool among the Rhodes scholars to sort of say, oh yeah, like I just applied to this. Someone suggested I do it. So I just like put in my application on a whim. Like that was definitely the cool thing to say. And I did not do that. Like I planned, strategized. You know, I worked really hard. I was extremely methodical about like, okay, this is what I'm going to have to achieve. Therefore, I'm going to do this. And that was all in service. I know I said it before, I'm not strategic. In this way, I really was. And it was all in service of, I was desperate to go to any one of the world's great universities because I thought that's where my people were going to be. And they were.
And did you find them?
Definitely. And then I think I found them again in the founder community in London. I think, by the way, I don't want to imply that these people are not in New Zealand, which it might sound like I think that 100% these people are in New Zealand. I just didn't know at that age in my life, like how to find them.
How did you decide what to do after you'd finished up at Oxford? And why was McKinsey the next right thing for you?
I think it is a thing for people who don't know what they want to do, which was me. And I've always been about opening up my options. I've always found it really hard to specialize because I'm interested in lots and lots and lots of different things. And I think this has always been a bit of a tension that I've seen, you know, friends of mine who specialize very early, like they rocket in their career. So, you know, my best friend at high school knew she wanted to be a doctor, always knew she wanted to be a doctor. And so she focused on that and she's now an incredibly successful doctor and she got there quite early. And people who were with me at McKinsey who knew what they wanted to do, you know, that if they knew they wanted to do banking or something and they focus on banking and they become partner like very quickly. And I'm the opposite. I have always just done random, interesting, non-strategic things aside from the scholarship. That's the only thing I think I've been strategic about. And so I've never specialized at any stage. So in Otago, I didn't just do one major. I did a double major, linguistics and politics. And then when I did my master's, I did an interdisciplinary master's that was not in either of the subjects that I did for my undergrad. It was in like three new subjects. It was history, anthropology, and economics. Even in my PhD, which PhD should be like the epitome of specialization, I did political economy and it was like very wide ranging. It wasn't even a specialized PhD really. And then from there, I went to McKinsey specifically because I wanted to experience lots of different countries. And so at McKinsey, I worked in Australia, I worked in Utah, I worked in Norway, Aberdeen, I went to Russia for a few months, I lived in South Africa, and I worked in retail, banking, oil, mining, healthcare, like everything.
I'm really curious how much of what you experience you believe would still be true today. And I ask from the perspective of there being a lot of ambitious people out there in the world who'd still look at sort of a gold-plated, you know, top-tier university and then a top-tier global consultancy as logical stepping stones. It's almost, you know, credentials you can acquire to progress and become more credible. But today, maybe you don't need to do that quite as much. You can start a company earlier. You know, there are other tracks. What would you tell your younger self, perhaps back in Kaggle, thinking about the 5 years ahead?
Yeah, I think that's very doable. I mean, it was always doable, but I think the internet in particular has really democratized access to advice. So, you know, it used to be that you would have to learn a lot of these lessons from scratch and you'd have to build a lot of the building blocks yourself. You know, AWS didn't exist. If I was starting any kind of internet company in 1996, I would have been like literally building physical servers somehow, you know? So I think firstly, like the barrier to entry is much lower because the building blocks are there, Shopify and all these things. But also the information about how to do it is so much more democratized. I found that even 10 years ago when I founded Quarry Kids in 2016, one of the first things I did was I spent about probably a week or two and I read two things obsessively. One was every single essay Paul Graham has ever written, and including there's a course, it was a Stanford course, I think it was 2008, so it was old even then, but very, very relevant. It's called How to Start a Startup. The other thing I read obsessively was I found this vault of stories, I think it was maybe held by TechCrunch or something. And it was basically someone had collected every single failure story. You know, when people write like a postmortem and they might publish it on Medium and they're like, well, my startup just failed, here's what I learned kind of thing. And then they say like five lessons they learned. I think I probably read over 500 of those because I kind of had an idea that like if I could just learn all of the ways in which everyone else had failed, if you just don't do that, then like you'll succeed. And anyway, so I spent like a week or two just obsessively reading those two things. I learned a lot from that. And I kind of learned like, you know, what are the main mistakes that everyone makes? And my point is, I was able to do that for free, you know, just with an internet connection. I didn't need to go on any like fancy expensive course or whatever because of the internet, because the internet now exists. I couldn't have done that in like 1998, but literally anyone could. The thing that I've just said, literally anyone can do that. And even now, you know, now we're 10 years on, there is just an insane amount of help and advice on the internet. It's all free. The barrier to entry is so low now.
So your path was somewhat conventional in the sense that you were chasing the roads, chasing the extrinsic recognition, you know, heading off to McKinsey, which is very storied and, you know, like a real CV booster in a sense. What made you strike out and go into startup land? And I'm guessing it wasn't just Paul Graham's essays. It was something that made you curious about maybe leaving the traditional track. Can you put it down to a certain experience or a person or an insight? Like what took you in that direction?
I had always wanted to run my own business. So as a kid, I was always setting up little businesses, some more legitimate than others. I definitely had at least one where my mum made me give all the money back and was quite scandalized.
Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, that was the lottery that I set up when I was about, I reckon I was probably about 10, and I set up a lottery among my friends. And the context here is that I come from quite a religious Christian family. My mom's like background is Presbyterian. So the idea of her daughter like not only gambling, but like actually being the casino was not cool for her.
Underage gambling den.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Classic in Chicago, that's what I think of.
I thought I had been genius in setting up the system, but like it was a rigged lottery, like I was definitely going to win. So it was, anyway, I had to give back all the money. But I was doing this and I had so many schemes. I had like, I used to sell things door to door and I used to wander around my high school. I carried a box of chocolate. This was less weird than it sounds. I know this sounds like very weird, but it was, I don't think it was as weird as it sounds. Everywhere I went in my high school, I carried a little box of chocolate, like chocolate bars, and people could buy them off me. So I was like a walking shop around my high school. I used to sell pastries to the teachers, like on spec. So they would order them off me. Like I remember that's where I learned what a samosa was. I never knew what a samosa was until a teacher bought it off my thing. And then I would take pre-orders and then I would go to the bakery and fill the orders and take a margin. So I had so many schemes.
With all of the side hustles, selling the chocolate, the bakery goods, I can see kind of see how you wound up in healthcare. Is there a direct link across there? Strategy and innovation at the NHS, Dr. Tom.
So when I was at McKinsey, I did lots and lots of very different things. And it got to the point, and I delayed specializing for a long time. And it got to the point where they said to me, HR said to me, it's really time, Rachel. Everyone who joined at the same time as you has specialized. You are the only holdout in your cohort. You are refusing to specialize in anything. You are flitting about, you know, like a dilettante. They didn't say it like this, but this was the message. You must now specialize. And so I had to choose. And I went with healthcare for two reasons. One was I just really liked the people who I was working with. And then the other one was, you know, rationally, it's a good thing. It's a good thing for the world. I want to be working on good things. I want to have a purpose. And so I went into it and I really enjoyed my time in it. And I did, I think, some really, really good work. The problem was, though, my heart wasn't really in it. And rationally, I was there. I mean, clearly, rationally, healthcare is obviously a good thing, right? But it just didn't, for whatever reason, it just didn't connect with me. I don't know why. And so that's why when I was working in healthcare and I had my baby and became aware of childcare, all of a sudden, for whatever reason, I can't explain why, it just grabbed me when healthcare didn't. And so I moved into childcare. And actually, there is quite a lot of commonality between healthcare and childcare. I think about it in very much similar ways. So I'm very glad that I did that time in healthcare, but I did it because I kind of had to.
Just on that, like drawing the thread from consulting to what became Quora Kids, the cool thing about consulting, especially as a young person, is you get thrown into all sorts of business problems, all sorts of industries, right at the very top, working with the C-suite. And it's a recipe for imposter syndrome, but it is also a fascinating like tour of business and a lived MBA. How do you reflect on your consulting experience and how you can apply it now as a founder, as a CEO at Quora Kids? When did it come up?
Yeah, it helps a lot. I think you learn, especially data analysis, you learn like analysis of markets, you learn a lot about leading teams, leading people, leading workshops, a lot about project management, and all these things are really essential skills, I think, as a founder. Certainly you can learn them in lots of other ways, but I think it's a great way to learn those things. It does leave big gaps though. And I think the biggest gap that it left me was, I think, two things. One is sales. You don't learn anything about sales, and sales is absolutely essential. As a founder, you're constantly selling all the time. And the other one that's like what I call hard-ass people management, which is like leading McKinsey people is the easiest thing in the world. And it's like riding a polo pony. Like you just think something and they like read your mind and go and do it.
They're all anxious overachievers.
Exactly. Right. They're literally the easiest people in the entire universe to lead. So you can learn some tricks which work with those types of people. And then you try them on other people and they fail dramatically. And also when there is a problem, you just call HR and you palm it off, right? You don't actually have to deal with it. Whereas in a startup, you have to deal with it. So I definitely came with some of these with big gaps. But I think McKinsey training is amazing training to be a founder. And realistically, anything you do, nothing's going to give you all the skills, right?
We have kind of got up to the present day, and I want to take a moment just to sort of reset the scene, because there's a lot of very interesting threads through how you got here that we can tie into Koro, like education and childcare, regulated industries, and both ones that have been getting more expensive over time, both ones that have interplay within government and public sector. Clearly, you have an interest in the public sector and public policy. Anybody who listens to this and doesn't yet follow you on LinkedIn should go and do that, because there's some fascinating reading. Before we go deep on Koro Kids, can you give us the pie chart of your attention? Like, how do you divide your time? What is the portfolio of interests and projects? And then, yeah, let's go straight through into Koro.
So I am trying a thing at the moment, but only for the last couple of weeks. So this will age quickly, where I'm actually writing a book at the moment. And so I'm trying to spend Monday and Friday on that book. I'm then spending probably another extra day at the moment on marketing content. And that is kind of like thought leadership or, you know, stuff that my marketing team can use. I then probably spend the remainder of the 2 days, probably of the other ones. One day I'm really working on partnerships as a kind of lead gen channel. And then I think the final day would be the like actually running the company, you know, everything else that I need to do. I think one of the things that is really great about the organization that I've built and kind of the stage I'm at now is I have a really, really strong leadership team, management team. And I'm constantly saying to them, like, what can I help with? What can I do? And they're kind of going, no, just do your thing. So I am now at the stage where I do try to dive into details, go in deep, probe, but I don't have to. I don't have to do like any of the operational kind of stuff, which is great.
That's amazing. Cast us back to the start of Quora Kids, and I imagine it was pretty different at the beginning.
Yeah.
Like you talked about having your first child and realizing how hard it was to get childcare, I'm guessing. What was the insight that made you think, this is actually a problem I want to solve? I'm going to throw away my storied career and go out on my own.
So I think when I first had a baby and I started looking for childcare, I was very lucky to find an incredible childminder who lived quite close. But I started hearing stories from friends, and they were stories about how impossible it was. And I think the thing that really struck me was the profundity of the consequences for them of not being able to find childcare. So these were people who I knew very well. You know, I'd known them for 10 years. And I knew how hard they'd worked for their careers. And I saw them stepping back from their careers that their entire life had been leading up to, you know, the job that they had. And it was impossible for them to combine that job with the terrible childcare situation. And so they left. I saw people moving out of London who I knew did not want to move out of London. And it was so that they could be nearer their family because of a lack of childcare. And so because the only way that they could see that they could make it work was through being near family. I saw people deciding not to have another child, which is like a major, major global problem now. So I think what really struck me was that working in the industry of childcare, it goes very deep, and it's not like, you know, selling shoes. You can sell shoes that are really sustainable and really great. At the end of the day, whether or not you buy the pair of shoes is kind of a rounding error on your life. Whereas childcare, it is fundamental to the entire rest of your existence. Whether or not to bring another human into the world, I mean, there's nothing more fundamental than that. That's what caught my attention. And then when I started looking into the industry, I discovered a bunch of things. You know, firstly, the people in the industry are not supported, they're underpaid, they don't have good career progression, they're disrespected. It is not a good industry to work in. And so there's a bunch of problems around there that need someone to take them seriously. And I looked around and I was trying to find, okay, who is working on this? And this was the second thing that struck me was when I was used to healthcare and I was doing innovation in healthcare. So I would go to innovation conferences. If you want to go to a healthcare innovation conference, almost every day in the world, somewhere, there is a healthcare innovation conference. And there are specialist investors. You guys know this well. There are specialist investors who all they do is healthcare investing. And there are thousands, I don't know, tens of thousands. How many startups in healthcare are there? Like countless, right? And so that was my ingoing mental assumption about childcare. Okay, this is a huge market, really important, super broken. Like there must be, and I remember I Googled childcare innovation conference with the expectation that there would be at least one, you know? And I was absolutely gobsmacked to find there were no conferences, there were no specialist investors, there was virtually no one working on this problem at all. And so I think I felt that was my next big realization is I'm going to have to do this. Like no one else is doing it.
I remember this really powerful quote I heard from you somewhere that you'd felt this almost righteous anger about how childcare had been disrespected as infrastructure. You think about things that motivate people to start companies. I haven't heard righteous anger before, but I do love that. And it was shared alongside a story, I think, about this the startup. Maybe you could retell this, but yeah, you weren't going all in until there was some minimum number of signups and that you were sitting over lunch and suddenly that started flowing in. From the context of a listener who's sitting on an itch they've got to scratch, the righteous anger they feel about something. Walk us through that, taking the leap.
Yeah, I was quite considered about this. I was in a job and I wanted to do a startup. And I was at a point in my life where I thought, I have always, my whole life, said that I will do a startup and all the ingredients are now together. For me, it was very important that I have a stable personal life because I can't cope with like more than one thing being unstable at once. And so I was married at that point. I had a baby. I had like payout's the wrong word. It sounds like a bad thing. Payout in a good way from my previous role. So I had some savings. So I was kind of like, okay, at this point in my life, I literally have all the ingredients to do a startup. So if I don't do a startup now, then I need to stop telling myself I'm ever going to do one because I'm just fooling myself. That was like the ingoing mindset. And I then went through a process to generate ideas and thoughts. And I came up with this one thing that I wanted to test. And then I set myself a 2-week goal. This was all basic. But by the way, remember, I'd read every single one of Paul Graham's essays. I didn't invent these ideas. I just implemented them. I said to myself, if I can get, and I can't remember what the number was. It's like 50 or something. It was some number that I thought, if I get this many signups in a 2-week period, then I will quit my job as a resolution. So I made a landing page, put a proposition up, nothing happened, promoted it in a few channels, nothing happened, blah, blah, blah. Like I did that for about a week, nothing happened. And then I tried a different channel, maybe tweak the proposition slightly. And I put my personal phone number on there and I went out to lunch with a friend and the phone rang. And I was like, oh, I'm really sorry. This is, it must be someone who's seen my thing. And so I sort of said, oh, I'll call you back. And then hang up the phone and then my phone rang again. And I was like, oh, it's weird. I, you know, answered and said, I'm sorry, I'll call you back in my lunch. And then I went back to my office and the exact combination of like tweaks and channel had just taken off and I blasted through the target. I think it was like Wednesday of the second week or something. Only just met my deadline. And that day I walked in and quit.
So you're building a marketplace here. But one thing that strikes me is as you're getting going in the mid-2010s, Uber is all the rage. You were perhaps the Uber for nannies, but you were also thinking about balancing supply and demand. But I'm really curious about how you think about this demand is flooding in. How do you now stimulate the supply side? And as the two, you know, each sort of ratchet up. And just to connect this back to the present day so that you can fill in the gap for us, I'd heard that you'd had nearly 10,000 nannies that had been hired in and that there was some tech and that there's some secret sauce that was used to identify these people. So really excited to hear your marketplace growth theory and all the bits in between.
Yeah, fairly typically in a marketplace, you need to build the supply first. So you're supply constrained first. And if anyone's interested in going deep on this, The Cold Start Problem is the book to read on getting a marketplace going.
That's the Andrew Chen one.
That's
the cold start problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
We'll pop that in the show notes. That's fantastic. Good shout out.
But what you do broadly is you build the supply side first, and we were supply constrained for probably 2 years, which is quite long. And the reason that we were supply constrained for that long was because we had an absolutely insane amount of latent demand. So I need to explain what specifically we're doing to explain why that is. So what we do is we provide after school nannies. That's what we're really famous for. We actually do more than that. We provide all sorts of different nannies. If you need a nanny, you should definitely check us out. But what we're famous for is covering that period of time from about 3 o'clock to about 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock for 4 to 10 year olds. And the reason we grew very fast in the early days was because literally we were the only people who actually had any supply for that job. The reason for that is because it's very hard to find someone who is both good enough to look after your kids for that period of time and also is willing to only work 3 hours. That's actually quite hard supply to find. To contrast it, if you want to find someone to look up to babysit on Saturday night, that is super easy. You can build supply for that very quickly. Also, if you want someone to look after your baby full time, again, very easy to build the supply for that very quickly. But the specific thing we were doing was very hard to build the supply for. And that's why no one else was doing it, because it was really hard. And because no one else was doing it, that's why we grew really fast on the demand side. So it took us 2 years. My first insight was to use university students. And so we really grew mostly from that, just one single source of supply. And I think that really allowed us to tailor all of our marketing channels, messaging, training, everything we did was tailored to that very tight persona. And we got to know details like which universities were the best for which kind of thing, which what courses were good. So, you know, you might assume that childcare and education courses are good, right? They're not, they're terrible. The reason they're terrible is because they have placements. And if you have a placement, it means that you can't commit to the job.
You know, Rachel, now we've just invested at Blackbird in a founder who started a company that she said wouldn't exist except for her job as a Cora Kids nanny. So she was a UCL student and joined Cora Kids in 2017, which must have been right in those early days. She was seeing in her behavioral psychology lectures the theory of educational attainment and how kids learn, and was so excited to implement these theories in practice. And then she would go off to her Cora Kids nanny job. She'd try and teach the kids maths and they'd be completely uninterested. And she was like, why my theory is not working? And so that whole insight and that experience being a nanny for Cora Kids led her, and I suppose the belief that there was someone else building a startup in education that was going really well, led her 7 years later to start Polymath, which is a kids' educational gaming platform. So there you go.
So cool. Yeah, I'm following those guys very closely. I think they're fantastic.
Tell me, within this marketplace you've created, you're stimulating supply, you've got fantastic nannies coming on. One of the concerns I've always had when thinking about this space was you can have something like Uber, where basically every driver is interchangeable. It doesn't matter who picks you up, so long as the car is a minimum amount, you know, minimum cleanliness. You have something like this where actually I really care a lot who the nanny is. As you say, I want to be really good. And once I know one, I want to make sure that, you know, the same one comes back. Have you ever had a problem around like keeping the supply on the platform, or were you not? Yeah, basically you've made the connection and you've created the value and they go off into the world. But just think again from the point of view of like a deplatforming risk would be one word for it. How would you tackle
that? This is always the key question with marketplaces, and different marketplaces cope with this in different ways. For us, it's really key that when you take on a nanny, you have to be the employer of the nanny. You can't not be. It's not a choice you can make. You just are. You are legally. And that brings with it certain employment obligations. So if your nanny gets sick, you owe them sick pay. If your nanny is pregnant, there's certain things that you have to do and can't do. You have to pay taxes. If your nanny is owed a pension, you have to set up that pension. So it comes with a lot of overhead admin, and we just solve all of that overhead admin for you. We make it like as easy as clicking a button, and we do pretty much everything in the background. And so that is hugely valued by our parents. We also do a lot with helping with ongoing payments and hours reporting. We also have in-house coaches to help the nannies with anything that they might encounter. So if the kid is on the autism spectrum, for example, and the nanny is having some challenges, we have people that they can talk things through with. So I guess the short answer to that is we provide a lot of value-added services over the longer term, and that inspires huge loyalty.
Yeah. And I mean, there's nothing quite as personal as who's looking after your children and who your children know is looking after them, right?
Yeah.
What have you learned about what makes a good nanny, and how do you know in advance when someone applies?
We've got so much data now, which is kind of one of the really fun bits of this. So last year, we had over 120,000 applications to become a Koru Kids nanny.
Wow.
So you start off with that size of top of the funnel. We'll say we only accept, last year, we accepted 6%. On our website, we say we accept 10%. The real figure last year was 6%. So extremely selective. And we have a kind of a matrix of things that we look for, like care and commitment. We have a thing called heart in the right place. We look for things around working as part of a team and growth mindsets. There's all these kind of indicators that we look for in their application. But the cool thing that we can do, because of the data and our scale and the nature of how we operate, is we can then trace it through to how did the nanny actually perform on the job. One of my big projects this year is we really want to take this to the next level. So we're already, I think, doing a pretty good job of understanding how these things relate to each other. But what we've just implemented is more questions around like the happiness of the child. We had a really deep think about like, what is our North Star for quality? Because you've got a business North Star, but how do we know if we're giving the best after-school service you could possibly give? And what kind of data could we collect on that? And it's actually quite hard for childcare because in education, if we were a school, you could say, well, it's, you know, performance in national exams, for example, or it's international rankings and stuff. And there's a lot of people have thought about how do you evaluate the quality of an education system. But how do you evaluate the quality of childcare and after school is actually very difficult because different kids need different things. So let's say you have a four-year-old who's overwhelmed by school and exhausted. That kid might need to come home and literally just blob. And like they might need comfort and warmth and absolutely no stimulation. That's not what they need right now. You don't need more education, right? We're not trying to just replicate school. But a different kid might need to be running around outside, like burning off. And then another different kid might actually need, you know, more like it might be brilliant to be doing science experiments and fun stuff and coding and whatever. We've had some deep thinking about what is the commonality between those three things, if actually what it looks like, quality for each kid is very different. And where we've got to is the one thing we can say is the child happy? And so that's become our North Star. And so we now ask, we try to keep them very simple, but we ask periodic questions of the family. We try to ask it relative to the previous form of childcare, because we thought that's a way of like anchoring and taking out some of the cultural differences with numbers. You know, if you ask a French person to rate something out of 10, they'll say 7, and that's very good. If you ask an American, 7 is like a total disaster, right? So there's problems with numerical scales. So what we ask is your child happier than in their previous childcare situation? And that's our way of kind of like normalizing a bit. And then the answers to that, using our data, this is a project I'm really excited about this year, we can use that data and relate it back to the nanny's initial application, but also their behavior during the platform. You know, are the nannies that are the most responsive? So let's say we know how quickly the nannies respond to messages. Is that a good predictor of how happy the kid's going to be? How cool would it be if it was, right? If we discover stuff like that, and then we can promote the nannies that are going to make your kid the happiest in our algorithm and not use these proxies, which may or may not be real. Like someone who has 5 years of experience versus 1 year of experience, it's not necessarily true that 5 years of experience is going to make your kid happier, right? But if we can find out the real things, then I'm really excited about that.
I've got another quote here, which I wanted to drop in before handing it back to Phoebe. I saw such again, somewhere online, probably LinkedIn. You spend a lot of time making things as easy as possible for the parents. Now you're focused on making things as exceptional as possible for the kids. And that really resonates with me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I love it.
I'd love to chat about the venture capital journey that you went on with Koru Kids. So you were married to a venture capitalist. What was the decision like to decide to go down the VC path? And then what was your experience like fundraising? Because I imagine at some times during that life of Koru Kids, you would have been pregnant while fundraising. You probably had, you know, maybe a mix of investor experiences. Would love any insight to that whole journey and like your reflections on it.
Yeah, I'm quite unusual in that I quite enjoy fundraising. I think a lot of people don't. Maybe it's because we've always been pretty successful. So it's been quite a positive experience for me, luckily. Although, obviously, we've had overwhelmingly no's. Even the most successful of startups have that. So the decision was really, I remember Dave saying to me, whatever you do, you're going to work really hard. So you may as well build a big business rather than a small one. And that really requires venture capital. So it was a conscious decision not to bootstrap. I think also with marketplaces, it's very hard, not impossible. We maybe could have done it, but we decided not to. I also just wanted to do it fast. I mean, this was 8 years ago, so I'm not sure I did do it fast, but that was part of the logic. And I wanted to have kind of the full experience. This is, again, I guess I go for the interesting but brutal experience rather than the more comfortable experience. And then I guess the final reason was, at the time, as you said before, Uber was coming up. There were a lot of marketplaces coming up. A lot of people said to me, you're going to have competitors. You need to do this fast. As it turns out, that was wrong. We have actually never had a competitor. Your guess is as good as mine. Like, why aren't other people doing it? I mean, it is really hard, but all startups are hard.
It's really hard, Rachel.
Yeah, but like, show me an easy market. You know, like, it is hard, but I actually do think it's surprising that we haven't had competitors or imitators in other countries. I do think that's surprising. Anyway, we haven't. But there was a belief, a reasonable belief that we would. And so therefore, we have to do this really quick. That's why I went for VC. And then the experience of it, I've always found it really, one of the reasons I like it is, well, I like to talk, but also I really have liked it as a means of strategy development. And I really would encourage people to think of it this way, actually. I think it's a positive way of thinking about it. And I think it actually makes you better at fundraising as well, if you have this mindset, that what you're doing is you're kind of getting some free strategy consulting from a whole range of different people. And they're going to ask you questions about your business and your plans. And some of those questions are going to be off base, and that's fine. Like, you can ignore those ones. But a lot of the questions will be really good questions. And if you don't know the answer, you should really go and find it out. And then you may as well tell them when you found it out. And that's part of the fundraising journey. But also, you really should know the answers, you know? And if they say, how are you going to cope with this? Or I know in the construction industry, some industry you don't know, right? And they're like, well, in the construction industry, it had this dynamic. So how are you going to cope with that? And that's a great thing for you to think about. Like, one of the problems I talk to a lot of founders about fundraising, and the biggest problem I frequently see is defensiveness and like a closedness to this stuff. You know, someone says like, oh, they were talking about construction. That's got nothing to do with what I'm talking about. You know, what an idiot. Versus like, no, what can I take from that question? Like, what can I learn? And very often it's a lot, actually.
To distill some of the echo, because I think there's a really good insight there. A lot of people do see fundraising as a chore. It's a thing you have to do along the way to pay the bills. In fact, you're seeing it as an opportunity to get market insights, to get feedback on your pitch, to craft your positioning. You're a CEO, you always have to be selling. You also had, I mean, it's not as unique these days, I think, but perhaps when you first set out, you're a non-technical founder building a startup and raising investment to build a technical business in a way. Do you have any particular advice to the founders out there who are considering that same route? You were, you know, all in on Airtable and all in on NoCo Tools. What's the distilled summary of your learnings that you'd share?
That's a huge question. I think we could talk about it for an hour because we've taken lots of different kinds of approaches to building new products, either tech first or ops first. And we have very live internal debates about what our lessons learned are, because there's pros and cons of each way of doing things. And our most successful product was built ops first on no-code tools. However, we experienced a lot of pain, like techifying it afterwards. And there's a school of thought within the company that it would have been better to do it product first much earlier in the journey, even though it did work. The school of thought is that it would have been more efficient to do it a different way and less capital intensive. We then have a couple of examples of things that we did product first without doing them ops first or no code first, and they didn't fly. We lacked the flexibility of humans to be able to change processes from morning to afternoon. So we are in the midst of that. I think if I could sum it up, I think either way can work. There are trade-offs. You can do each way badly or well, and it's really hard either way is my summary.
But it's also really good to be able to just get going. So I love that.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely 100% my bias.
So what was it like raising venture capital while pregnant?
It was very challenging. I raised £3.5 million in 2018, and I had a baby in the middle of that fundraise. And so it was my son. This was pre-COVID. And pre-COVID was much harder because you had to go physically to meetings. There were no video meetings at all. And so I was literally 9 months pregnant. And the thing is, you don't actually see people who are 9 months pregnant, because people who are 9 months pregnant tend to just stay home. And so people are not used to seeing them. You know, you're used to seeing like people who are 3 or 6 months pregnant or whatever, but you look like a clown. And you know, I refuse to buy maternity stuff and like none of my clothes fit. I just look like an idiot. You're also really hot. One of the important things about fundraising is it's the sales funnel. And the more meetings you can cram into a day, the higher chance you're going to get of competitive term sheets, which is what you're aiming for. And you need to get them all at the same time. Timing is crucial. So that means you have to cram as many meetings into your day as possible. And the fastest way to get around London is the tube. It's not taxis because they get stuck in traffic. So I was 9 months pregnant and I would be walking or running up the stairs in the tube to try and cram in these meetings. I would then arrive and I would be huge, mismatched, flustered, red, sweating. And there would be a crowd of like five men and I would be having to like sell them this pitch. Then I had a baby, had the baby on the Sunday. I was doing phone calls on the Monday and I was back to in-person pitching on the Wednesday. I then continued through that month. My husband took a month off, which was great. I couldn't have done it without him. And so he would come along with me. So I was breastfeeding during this whole time. We were now in like partner pitches and ICs and stuff. And so we would travel by taxi. I would then breastfeed in the lobby. He would hold the baby. I would go in, do my pitch, and then come out. And then we would go to the next meeting. You know what? It was really tough, but it was also, it was fun. It was a fun challenge. And again, this is a mindset thing. Sometimes I very often speak to female founders, pregnant founders, and there's often a belief that people will look negatively on them for doing this. I don't think anyone did. I think if anything, I feel like they thought I was crazy in a good way. And when you're trying to persuade someone you're going to change the world and you're going to stop at nothing and you had a baby 2 days ago, you don't need to say anything more than that.
Crazy in a good way is another alternate title for this episode, I think. And we started out talking about brutal honesty. This has been phenomenal. I think we could have actually gone for another hour. I'm going to tuck a couple of really quick rapid fire questions at the end because I know we've got about 2 or 3 minutes left. First one was, you mentioned that you're writing a book 2 days a week and we didn't pause to ask you, what is it about? What's the book pitch in 30 seconds?
It is called 10 Minutes to Change Your Life. And it's about how you can do micro interventions with children to reset their mindset and help them tell positive stories for themselves that are going to last their whole lives long.
That's brilliant. When's it out?
I mean, it's like an outline at this stage.
Okay, we'll keep folks posted. You have spent a bit of time thinking about the UK political space. I'd be very curious how closely you're following New Zealand and if you were working with or advising or even in charge of the government down here, what's one thing you'd do?
I'm very interested in what's going on in New Zealand, but I really don't feel close enough to it. When I go home, which is once a year, I always ask tons of questions and I love catching up on all the end of year roundups that happen around Christmas time. But it is a sadness in my life that I feel a little bit distant from it, honestly.
Final question. How can we help you? What are your asks? What are your upcoming challenges, requests of the Diaspora Network?
I do a lot of campaigning on LinkedIn and I would love any amplification of the work that I do on LinkedIn. I try to do a lot of advocacy for things that affect parents and affect children. So connect with me there, follow there and chat and comment and all of that. I would love that.
Brilliant. And customers, UK parents at the moment, any plans for other countries?
We are considering it. Maybe New York. If anyone finds that an interesting statement, I would love to speak to you.
Brilliant. We'll wrap it up there, Rachel. That's fantastic. Again, we wish we had a lot more time, but we didn't, so we'll have to do it again. Thank you for coming on, and we will look forward to seeing you soon.
Cheers.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. As a quick reminder, make sure you hit subscribe in your favorite podcast player so you can keep hearing stories like this landing your feed every Friday. Power you through those weekend chores. I want to give a quick shout out to the boys at Supermix who do all our editing. Zach and Xavier are Kiwi expats themselves. They're building a thriving business in the heart of New York City. A lot of respect. Not a sponsor, just a happy customer here. Also, for my day job, I'm an entrepreneur in residence and an investor at Blackbird Ventures. We're backing the best Kiwi founders wherever they are in the world. My personal sweet spot is pre-seed and seed. I like to say no check is too early, so drop me a line anytime. It's dbooth@blackbird.vc. We'll look forward to seeing you back next week.